Log Talk Radio.
You have made it to Stu and the Nun, an online radio show that looks to inform, educate, and hopefully make you laugh. Stu and the Nun is a show focused on national security, policy, politics, and selfless service. We do this by not only interviewing guests, but also sharing our perspectives and asking you, the listener, to interact with us on our show chat room, via our Facebook page, and on Twitter.
Good evening, everybody. This is The Nun. We are live on the Blog Talk Radio. My main man, my brother from another motherland, co-host, The Stu, is joining us tonight. He is from the mobile studio, which is code word for wherever he is working his real job, hotel room. But we have a great show tonight. Stu, are you excited?
Dude, I'm beyond excited, and I know all of our listeners are too. This has been a show we have been looking, you and I have been looking forward to for months, and I know our guests, our listeners have been looking to it for weeks, and heck, who knows, maybe even our guests have been looking forward to it, but we can find out for them when we talk to them here in a little bit.
But yeah, totally no, I put on my radio face and turned on my television voice, and I'm ready to get this show on the road.
Absolutely. Tonight I want to welcome everybody to another episode of Stu and the Nun. Again, we are very excited to have you all here. This is our, 26th episode, and we are so glad tonight to have the Commanding General of Forces Command, General Robert Abe Abrams. General Abrams, you may recognize the name if you've heard it. Maybe you have to Google that, see if you've ever heard it before. But he comes from a long line of military heritage and family. Brothers, sisters, of course, his father. Toby, a good friend of ours, Chuck Ziegenfuss, even named his oldest son after General Abrams' dad. Named his son Creighton because he's that much of a tanker himself, our buddy Chuck.
No, that is the truth.
Yeah. So we're going to have him on tonight talking about, man, what's going on in Forces Command, what's going on in the Army, kind of what the state of it is. We are catching General Abrams he may have just stepped off the plane a few hours ago, but he's been touring theater. We're so lucky to have him coming right out of, he's been tweeting and we're going to talk about that. And he's been all over Kuwait and Afghanistan and getting a sense from the troops of how the morale is and what's happening over there. So we're very excited and just super fortunate to get this opportunity. So yeah, if you're tuned in live, you're about to get a great show. And if you're listening to this after the fact, you're still going to hear a great show, just you didn't get to hear it live. About the only difference. So, there we go.
Well, you know, from stepping off of the plane onto Stu and the Nun, I mean, they're basically, you know, that's life in the fast lane for a jet-setting general. But I'm excited. Lots going on this week out in the world that we're going to get to afterwards. But, Troy, without further ado, I think it's time to get this party started.
I say so. We don't want to waste a minute of this opportunity. So I want to welcome for his first appearance on Stu and the Nun, an old friend of mine, my old company commander from way back in the day, and the current Forces Command Commanding General, Robert A. Abrams. Hey, sir, welcome to the show.
Hey, Troy and Toby, thanks for having me on. And I actually have been looking forward to this opportunity. Fire away, but appreciate the opportunity to get on with you.
Awesome. We're glad, and it's good for us to catch up. You and I haven't seen each other since, I think you were a lowly two-star at the time in charge of Rock of the Marne, 3rd ID. And the last time you and I have got to see each other, so it's good to talk to you live for sure.
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of water under the bridge since that last one. So, but it's all been good. And I did, as you mentioned, I did just get back from theater. I got back late Sunday, and I'm on travel again. I'm out visiting one of our divisions, and you'll see photos sometime tomorrow. But it's always good. It's re-energizing to be around soldiers. And so it was great at theater, and I look forward to sharing some observations with you.
Awesome, awesome. Well, we're going to get right into it. So, you know, we're going to without, no doubt, you answer what you feel comfortable to. You can dive off and digress and whatever you want. We're just going to – we have a few put together just to kind of guide this conversation. So I want to start with the ForceCom mission, now that you are the commander of ForceCom and have been for a little while. So since you took over, and I believe that was – probably around July, August, I think, right, when it kind of got confirmed or something. How any major surprises, I guess, since taking over ForceCom, anything that you didn't expect or didn't anticipate when you stepped into the role?
Yeah, so the change of command was 10 August, and to be honest, there hasn't really been any surprises. I was fortunate in my last 90 to 120 days working for the Secretary, for Secretary Carter. He had me do a special project for him and the chairman to look at joint force readiness. So I was able to travel across all the joint forces. I got unfettered access into not only just the Army, but the Navy, the Marines, and the Air Force, travel all over and really do a deep dive into readiness. Not knowing what my next job was going to be, because that didn't get announced until, I think it was July. So it really, though, served as a great primer for me, and it allowed me to really get an in-depth view of, what's going well in terms of readiness just inside the Army, and then, frankly, what's not going well, and what our challenges are. So I haven't seen any surprises, but I can give you and your audience just a couple of observations. So, as I tell people, and this is, both people that are inside and outside the service, we really do have an incredible, I think it's the best Army we've ever had right now. And we've got the most combat experience. But we're losing that every day as soldiers ETS and retire. But it is the most combat experience. We've got incredibly high quality, the best equipment, the best training, and it's incredible what we're able to do. And so I got to see a lot of that this last week when I was downrange and in theater. But as good as we are, there are some things that we are not very good at. And so I tell people, I go, today, if you compare today's non-commissioned officers, who I truly believe are the backbone of our Army, if you compare the NCOs of today with, when you were a young sergeant, when I was a young company commander, our staff sergeants and sergeants first class back then, they were fantastic, but they were, clearly focused only on combined arms maneuver war fighting. Today, if you take a staff sergeant or a sergeant first class and you throw them in the middle of a host nation police station and tell them, hey, I want you to train the local national police force, combat arms guys, just throw them in there, they're very comfortable with that. They're comfortable with ambiguity. They're comfortable with having to deal with host nations. You can throw in a law enforcement professional from some retired state trooper or somebody else to advise them. You can throw at them some non-governmental organizations. You can have some media guys show up. You can make them work through a translator. And our non-commissioned officers today, very, very comfortable in that environment. Back in the 80s, when I was a company commander, we never talked to anybody. We'd go to a combat training center, and it was focused on killing the op corps. So incredible capability and depth and really just ability to operate in today's environment. But what our NCOs don't have today, they actually don't have the technical and tactical expertise that our NCOs had back in the 80s and 90s for combined arms maneuver. And it manifests itself in a number of different ways, and I can give you plenty of examples. But one of my favorite examples is ran into a master gunner a couple of months ago at a tank range, and he'd been at a master gunner school about 5 months, and I said, he's been in the Army 8 years, I said, hey, how many gunneries have you fired? He said, well, before I went to master gunner school, I had fired 3. Now, you compare that with an NCO of the tanker 8 years in the Army of the 80s and 90s, he probably would have already fired 15 or so gunneries thus far in his time in the Army. And he hasn't had the operational experience on a tank to really qualify him to be a master gunner. But, you know, he's been busy doing other things. So, as I tell people, we got a great Army, but there are things that we're just flat rusty in, and we're not as ready as we need to be. And if somebody was to call us out right now, we'd have some real challenges. That's a long answer, but I wanted to sort of use that to sort of set the tone for the rest of the conversation.
No, that's good, and you segued right into pretty much my next question, which was how is ForceCom adapting to the changing of its focus, if you've been able to yet, of the changing threats, like the major cyber threats, ISIS, small third world countries now hosting threat actors, things along that line that have been out of the typical, force on force, if you were, even what has been unfortunately typical for the last 13, 14 years, the 360-degree asymmetrical battlefield, these new threats, how is ForceCom changing for that?
So it's not just ForceCom, but it's across the Department of the Army. And so we've done it a couple of ways. So the first thing that, you know, people want to understand is that, you're right, we did. For 13, 14 years now, our combat training centers and home station have been focused on a counterinsurgency/train-advise-and-assist environment because those are the directed missions that we're performing in Iraq and Afghanistan specifically. But our numbers there have shrunk considerably. At the height of the war in Iraq, we had 170,000 soldiers on the ground, and today we're somewhere just under 4,000. And Afghanistan, today I think open press is about 9,800. I think is our number, and that's down significantly from the height of what we had in Afghanistan. But what we train in now today is what we call the decisive action training environment. In a decisive action training environment, you've got a opposing force, an environment that includes conventional force, unconventional force, guerrilla forces, irregular forces. If you don't take the right actions, you'll probably have an emerging insurgency. You got to deal with host nation security forces, host nation officials. It reflects the reality of the very complex world that we live in. There is an electronic warfare capability now in our combat training centers. There is a, no kidding, cyber component at our combat training centers today that really challenges everyone, and it affords us to really explore the possibilities with our cyber mission force that we're building. Both offensive and defensive. So it's a very complex environment. This is not your father's combat training centers. And so as a result, at home station, we've got to be, we're prepping units for that very complex environment. But look, the big takeaway, though, is if you think back to how it was in the 80s and 90s as we prepared to fight the outboard combat training centers, we put a premium on memorization, basically, of what to think about the Op 4. The Op 4 was, you had these doctrinal templates, you would apply it to the terrain, and, we sort of memorized what sort of actions, reaction, counteraction the Op 4 would take. And so the premium was on what to think. So if you could memorize and understood how the Op 4 was organized and what he wanted to do, then you could do a pretty good job with predictive behavior, and apply to the terrain and give the blue, sort of a fair fight. Today, that complex environment, there's so many different variations of action, reaction, counteraction. The premium now that we put on leaders especially is how to think. You got to be able to think on your feet in today's complex world, and that's what we're doing at our combat training center. So it's a pretty exciting time. And no rotation, no two rotations are the same now, which is really fantastic. So you don't have people saying, oh, I know what happened three rotations ago, therefore I can predict what the out-four is going to do. It's different every time because it's truly an action-reaction-counteraction environment. So that's part one. Part two, I'd say, the other big change that we're doing across the Army is we're moving away from an Army force generation model to a sustainable readiness model. And, you know, our Army force generation was the right readiness paradigm, if you will, to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. But it was about providing, building readiness for a specific time, a specific location, to arrive on a specific latest arrival date, the LAD. Everybody knows about it. We are a LAD-based Army. And you didn't have to be ready 1 day, 1 week, 1 month before your LAD. You built readiness over time for that one moment. Then when you got there, you had to be ready. And then we used that readiness up. You know, we weren't doing a lot of training in a lot of cases. We just got there at the highest state of readiness. We'd use up the readiness when we came home. You know, we take 40% of the unit away, rip out all the leaders, send equipment off to reset, and suddenly the unit was at a much, much lower state of readiness, and then we spent the next 9 to 12 months building it back up. We're now moving to a sustainable readiness model, and that is much more like instead of an assembly line like we would use to build a car to deliver to a dealership, a sustainable readiness model is have built that car, equipping that car, and then maintaining that car all the time. So if you think back to the 80s and 90s, think back to the band of excellence that we used to have in our training doctrine. That's what sustainable readiness is about. It's about being ready not for one point in time, it's about being ready all the time. And frankly, what in my travels, that's going to be the hardest. We'll figure out the manning and the equipment and all that other stuff. The hard part is going to get between people's ears to get back to a mindset of being ready all the time. Right now, that's resident in really the global response force. We got to actually get that in the rest of the Army. Let me stop there and see where that takes you.
Yeah. Well, I just want, before Toby, I know Toby's got something, I just want to say, that reminds me of the old saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Right?
Yeah.
Go right back to where we were.
So with all that said, which I think you just gave us a brilliant snapshot of a lot of stuff, has the recent decision opening up, you know, Army jobs, specifically combat MOSs, not just within the Army, but throughout all the, you know, defense modes, is that changing anything specifically with ForceCom? Like right now, I know it's, in everyone's mind, it's this notional change, but it's actually happening, and you know, people are enlisting and entering TRADOC to go through this. But at your level, is anything changing? Is there guidance that, you know, being given to like adjust fire on different missions or anything like that?
Well, let me talk about that for a second. So this was, you know, when the directive was given by Secretary Panetta 3 years ago. The Army set out on a charter on how to best approach this and evaluate things. So one of the things, I'm really proud of our Army for how we approach this, because TRADOC took the lead and really brought in a cross-domain from across academia, across you know, fitness experts, and plenty of other think tanks and plenty of other people to really study on how to approach this should the Army leadership decide to not seek an exemption, which we obviously did not. And so from that, you know, we all know this, those of us who serve in combat arms, we haven't changed our specific requirements for individuals in combat arms MOSs, in fact, all MOSs, in about 25, 30 years. They were outdated. So they did a very, TRADOC did an excellent job going into ForceCom, supported by ForceCom, to do a no-kidding analysis, assessment, and analysis of what tasks are really required. What tasks are required for an armored crewman, a combat infantryman, a scout, you know, 13 Bravo, an artilleryman. And from that, these no kidding skills required, they developed a, they were able to develop a set of standards that are gender neutral, because it, you know, it's the requirement is a requirement regardless of gender, and it was pretty eye opening for a lot of people. And then from that, and you've probably seen this in the media over the last week or so, from that now, what we're going to be able to do is we're going to start at, you know, at the MET station, we're going to do an initial assessment. It's called an occupational physical assessment test. It's four events. It's a predictive tool that if a a recruit or someone who wants to come into service thinks they want to be a combat infantryman, they take this four event OPAT, we call it, and based on their score, we can predict if they have the physical potential to be able to go to basic training, AIT, and come out, you know, with a blue cord. And then at the end of that, so at the end of AIT, you'd actually have to take the OPAT again and achieve a higher standard that meets the basic minimum requirements to serve in that military occupational specialty. So this is actually going to be, I think, it's actually going to raise standards. So the combination of those two, the study that was done, the revised, and we did this, I think, for 35 MOSs, the physical requirements required, that plus the OPAT, it's actually going to raise standards. So that's part one. Part two, I got to be honest with you, too, and this is not a secret. It shouldn't be a secret. The what we have found out so far, and this may change over time, but the propensity for females to serve in combat arms initially right now is pretty doggone low. So the first two MOSs, the next two MOSs, I should say, that we're going to bring female soldiers into are 13 Bravo and 13 Delta. And I was just looking at the numbers today because I've got the draft implementation plan for Forcecom, and you know, the staff has come to me with, based on the very limited numbers, we're going to target, I want to say it's 40 of one and 50 of another. That's it so far.
Wow.
We're going to target three different brigades in the Army, three installations, three different brigade combat teams, to serve as the pilot. Because one of the things we've learned, as you know, I think you guys know this, we started integrating women into brigade combat teams in every battalion starting in 2011, right?
Correct.
And we learned a lot of good things from that. Some things we did well, some things we didn't. What we learned is that it's not going to be success if you take one or two females and try to put them in an infantry battalion to work in the battalion S1 shop or work in the battalion S2 shop. You've got to have a certain number of female officers, you've got to have a certain number of female non-commissioned officers, and a certain number of female soldiers, so that it's not overwhelming, but they've got an adequate support network, but they're there in enough numbers so that in the battalion it becomes commonplace to be able to see female soldiers serving in those positions. And frankly, it's been a success story that you haven't read much about. They're serving everywhere and doing very, very well, just not in a lot of numbers. So, but this back to this propensity. So we already know on the officer side, I want to say, and I don't, you can't quote me on this, but it's really low. I think there's, in this upcoming West Point class that's going to graduate this May, I want to say there's five or six that have indicated they want to be an armor officer, and four who have said they want to be an infantry officer. Not very large numbers. That will change over time, but right now the propensity to serve based on our surveys in combat arms is pretty low. So knowing that, the ones that do want to serve, people are concerned about physical capability. Hey, you got to look no further than those three females who got the Ranger tip. They're going to be motivated. They're physically capable. They're all in. And frankly, I think it's going to raise people's standards. People are going to step up to the plate. And truly, we want the best leaders. We don't care about gender. We want the best leaders, and we want the best soldiers. So this will be a will there be some rough spots as we go? Sure, but we've learned some great lessons since 2011. We're not going to try to integrate across every unit in the Army. We're going to have some select units, and so that we've got the right density, and we'll take it from there. Let me see if that scratches your itch.
No, it really did, because, you know, like, my follow-on was, you know, was the integration prepared for, and it sounds like it really is, and it's nice to know that there's a strategy behind it. I went back and did an awesome visit earlier this year with the unit that I served with, the 1st and the 23rd, the Tomahawks out of the Striker Brigade out there, Fort Lewis. And at the time, I went back and visited the adjutant, the S1 officer, was an amazing young woman that, you know, was toeing the line and doing great stuff out there. And I was, like, super impressed to see that. When I first walked into the office, I was a little shocked, like, this is a little different, but when you see the caliber of work, the professionalism, and the maintaining of the standard, you can't help but support. And, you know, again, you know, I think there's a big difference between this and don't ask, don't tell. You know, in an infantryman, you know, I can only speak for myself and those that I served with and that I think were like-minded. You know, the point of domination is, you know, what's important, getting through that door, doing your job, being technically and tactically proficient. You know, what your off-duty time is and what you look like, that was irrelevant to your performance. And, you know, it's great to see that as long as the standard's not. And it sounds like the plan has been amazingly done. But I think Troy's got another question for you.
Okay, go ahead.
All right. So, sir, when you, for a little while there, right before you took this job, you were serving as the senior military advisor to the Secretary of Defense. While you're doing that, I guess, or in hindsight now, has that changed your outlook in any way professionally, personally, or politically?
Well, I'll talk about personally and professionally. Look, it was an amazing honor to serve as Secretary Hagel, senior military assistant. An incredible selfless servant and, two-time senator from the state of Nebraska, and then, of course, was our Secretary of Defense. You know, he volunteered, to serve his country, and he went to Vietnam with his brother. He didn't get drafted. He volunteered, and he did for a number of reasons, and I'll let him state his case. It was an incredibly educational and developmental assignment for me. For someone, I had served in the Joint Staff before, and I certainly served, you know, at high levels as a combined Joint Task Force commander there in Afghanistan and as a division commander. But operating at that level, at the national level, in support of the Secretary was an amazing experience. And, I learned something every day. I learned a lot about him from him. I learned about how our government works, and I really found out and learned how policy is made, how policy adjustments are made, and sort of the nexus between policy, best military advice, policy, and implementation. So, professionally, it was incredibly rewarding. Personally, I got to be honest with you, it's probably in the top two hardest jobs I've ever had since I'm in my 34th year of service. That's truly we talk about 24/7. That was no kidding, 24/7. He's part of the National Command Authority. He's got, he's part of the Nuclear Weapon Release Authority chain. He's got a number of responsibilities to protect the homeland. So it literally is a 24/7 responsibility. So personally, it was hard work. I went around the world four separate times. We traveled a lot, but went around the earth four different trips, three in one direction and one in the other. And I lost count of how many miles we went. So, but it was incredibly incredibly rewarding experience. And I got to work with some tremendous people. I gained a new appreciation for civ-mil relations. You know, I call myself fortunate to be able to have established, I had some incredible colleagues on the OSD staff, some political appointees, others were just, or that were Senate confirmed officials, others were just straight political appointees. Really an incredible experience. And these are people that I'll be friends with, for the rest of the time I'm serving and hopefully after. Some incredible professionals that actually don't get a lot of, they don't get a lot of fanfare, but they are committed to what you and I stand for and what we believe in.
That's awesome. Not too many people probably come to a job like ForceCom Commander and look at it as maybe a break.
This is a that was an incredible. I got to tell you, that was it was unbelievably rewarding. But when you get the Secretary of Defense with all of the responsibility, the weight of the world on his shoulders, I served on a great team. It wasn't just me. We had a great team between my counterpart, the Secretary's Chief of Staff, a couple other military assistants, but a whole infrastructure, comms team, security team, our policy team, all of that to make sure that the Secretary was at the right place at the right time with the right information to be able to, advocate on behalf of the Department of Defense to make recommendations and to implement policy. So, I'd say this was a throttle back when I got to ForceCom, believe it or not.
Yeah, I imagine. All right. So on to the next one. I'm kind of curious, what is it like to have a normal command decision, like a court-martial referral, if you would, become such a viral and visible thing in both the mainstream media and social media? What was that like? Did you expect it, I guess? And how has that been in your 34 years of military service as an event?
Yeah. Well, look, I don't look at any one case and try to draw some conclusion from that. So I'll speak in sort of general terms about decisions that we have to make as leaders. Because, as a battalion commander, you make decisions. They may not be high profile from outside that battalion, but it's pretty doggone high profile inside that battalion. In other words, people will react almost instantly across a battalion of 600 to 800 men and women, plus all their family members. So, but the higher we go, the more our decisions affect people. So here's sort of my guiding light. First and foremost, we have to remember the oath we took. And our first priority has to be, what is best for the institution? Our profession is founded on principles and values. And in the end, that's what separates us as a profession. And that has sort of been my guiding light from the time I was a company commander, until today. Certainly the impact of decisions I make today are much broader and affect certainly more people today than they did when I was a company commander. But first and foremost comes what's best for the institution. We got to do what's right and best for the institution. And then from that, you make decisions. When it comes to adjudicating things, that's a separate story. That's sort of separate considerations, and that's all covered. But that's sort of been my guiding light my whole career. What's best for the institution? What's best for my unit? And then what's best for the Army? And I think if leaders stick to that, then generally they'll do the right thing for everybody.
Yeah. Well, I know when I got an ass chewing from you one time as a company commander, and I know I've told you this before, it was a significant major emotional event for me. So it may have not affected too many other folks, but I've still to this day never forgot it. But
that's how you got to handle those things. And everybody's, every commander at every echelon is faced with tough calls. And that's what I tell them. I go and talk to the pre-command course. I talk to both the lieutenant colonel and command sergeant major and the colonel and their command sergeant major pre-command course. This is one of the topics I talk about, this authority that they have under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and, you know, what they need to think through as they've got to make their independent decisions. And, you know, there's no cookie-cutter approach, but, you know, you've got to have some overarching principles.
Well, sir, you're talking about the good of the institution, and I got to tell you, like, speaking of the institution, there's this one called the United States of America, and there's some memes out there, these motivational posters that are calling for you to run for president. How does that make you feel, like, knowing that sometimes, you know, like, that might be the first time, like, a force comm commander's ever called for, like, let's run. So how does that make you feel, knowing that, you know, one, as the, what, with the maturity and the professionalism that you're handling a lot of these things that are being thrown at you, that the people are behind you, and as a result, they're, like, they're calling for you to, you know, achieve an even greater level of leadership?
Well, to be honest with you, aside from, you know, my little small contribution that I try to make in getting the word out about our Army and great soldiers on Twitter, I generally have zero contact with any other social media. So, you know, somebody forwarded me something, a Gold Star wife forwarded me something a couple of weeks ago. I think that's what you're making reference to. But to be honest with you, I don't really pay attention to that. And that's not who I am. I'm a soldier, and you know, I don't worry about those things. And you know, I'm just trying to be the best commanding general of U.S. Army Forces Command that I can to build and sustain readiness for, you know, 800,000 plus soldiers across our total force. So that's all active in force comp plus all the National Guardsmen, all 342,000 or so as it is today, and 195,000 U.S. Army reservists and all their families. You know, that's what sort of drives me, and that's where I'm sort of focused.
Well, we didn't expect any other than that, yeah, you know, out of your mouth, sir, and that's one of the reasons, you know, why you're in the position that you're in is because you actually understand and respect it. But with that, there have been some of your peer group. When I say peer group, I mean some Navy admirals, some other Army general officers that have been kind of getting in trouble lately. And maybe, is this a new thing, or is it just because the information age, we're able to see this stuff more and maybe we're paying attention more? But there seems to be in the past 6 years just a rash of, like, poor behavior out of general officers. Everything from getting drunk at golf tournaments to, you know, having crazy affairs with subordinates, you know, that involve other things as well as other inappropriate, you know, public altercations. Is this a new thing, or is this, we're just able to see it now?
I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's certainly got a lot more visibility today because of social media and other things. Look, senior leader misconduct is nothing. No one's proud of it. And what we have to do, you know, as, you know, just in our service in the Army, you know, we've got to police ourselves, and we've got to hold ourselves accountable to the high standards that we all aspire to, that we all talk about. Things that we learned as either a brand new soldier or as a brand new lieutenant. So I don't, you know, we've had people sort of lose their way and do crazy things and, you know, break the law, egregious violations of trust and confidence. And, you know, frankly, we've got to hold ourselves accountable. So, but look, we're all human, and so. You know, I don't want to, you know, lead anybody to believe that, you know, flag officers are not human beings. But having said that, you know, when it comes to illegal, immoral, and unethical behavior, you know, we all have, everyone's accountable for their actions. I'm accountable for my actions. And I'm by no means perfect. You know, I make mistakes, but, and we all want to be held accountable. But there are things that are completely unacceptable. And you've outlined some and so forth. So, now, one thing that is not well documented, now you've seen a couple of high-profile cases, I actually have pretty good confidence that we hold ourselves accountable. The difference, though, between us and maybe other services is we don't do it publicly. We don't publish the results of how we hold people accountable, except in the rare cases of a few high-profile cases where they're played out in the national media. But generally speaking, I feel pretty good that we do hold ourselves to a pretty high standard, and we do hold people accountable. And I do talk about this with, because I speak to all the GO courses. At this point, because of the numbers that we've had over the last few years, you said 6 years, maybe the last 10 years. What I tell them is, I said, hey. You know, there's things you've got to do. You've got to make sure that you know the rules. You've got to make sure your staff is watching out for you. That you've got someone watching your back. You've got somebody who can go in there and tell you, hey, you're getting on the edge. You know, hey, you're starting to make some. I'm starting to have some questions to sort of get you between the lines. And then we've got to be honest with ourselves. And be, when you see others sort of stepping, you know, starting to sway towards wrong areas or making some bad decisions, we gotta be professionals and confront each other and hold each other accountable. Because at this point, every time we have one, as I tell them, it's got the effect of 10 or 15 other misconducts that might have occurred 10 years ago. 10 years ago, some people would have said, oh, that's no big deal. But we've had enough now that it's eroded the trust of our soldiers, it's eroded trust in our families, it's eroded trust in the American people, the Congress of the United States. And we got to earn that trust back. So, I think it's a, you know, you raise a legitimate point, and it's something that, you know, I can tell you that the senior leaders of our Army are focused like a laser beam on. And I think we're doing a pretty good job holding each other accountable. We just got to do better and not having anybody lose their way.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, sir. No doubt.
I got time for one more, and then I gotta prep for tomorrow. I'm visiting a division tomorrow, and I gotta get appropriate rest tonight to make sure that I'm ready for PT tomorrow.
Oh, come on now. You're not getting old on me, are you? Come on. You should be able to go all night.
Well, me and the Fort Scott Command Sergeant Major are traveling together. And we like to do so. We're going to show up at a unit tomorrow and do PT with them. And they always they're always looking to try to break it off on both of us. And so we got to be ready.
Okay.
And when they try to break you off, you take a selfie afterwards, showing that they did not. I love that one last week from Fort Lewis, where you're like, I'm sorry, guys. But, yeah, great PT session. I'm still alive, and I'm smiling.
Yeah, that was actually quite a gladiator event. You know, the Sergeant Major and I tell them, hey, we'll do whatever the unit's doing. And in that particular unit, they had representatives from every company. It was like a gladiator event. And so it wasn't like we were doing PT with one platoon. We had, like, all the studs out of one battalion showed up to try to kill us. So, but it was good. Good
workout.
Good PT session.
Good deal. Hey, sir, I'm going to push you for two, just because we have so many two that are really important. I think you want to hear it. You do it. Theater, you're talking to a lot of soldiers. You do it at Fort Lewis, and getting the sensing, an almost impromptu sensing session that you've been doing as you talk to them. Are you seeing any of the political or social issues going on today, dealing with? The VA complaints, the numbers, 22 suicides a day by veterans and soldiers and all military. Are you seeing that kind of stuff that's out there socially affecting morale of the soldiers? Or are they talking to you about it? Are they asking you about it?
To be honest with you, no. I mean, they got plenty to talk to us about. And again, Sergeant Major Schroeder was with me the last week while we were in theater. and we do a lot of traveling together. There's plenty of other things on their mind. That's not one of them. I will tell you, you raised the issue about suicides, and you asked, you know, specifically about veteran suicide. And I'm as concerned as anybody else. It's really bothersome. But look, I got to be honest with you. We haven't taken our eye off the ball on active duty suicide. So, you know, we just saw a report about 2014. The 2015 numbers will be out soon. You know, 2015 we had a better year. We did, you know, we had less suicides in the active force, but we had a huge increase in the Army National Guard and U.S. Army Reserve. That is really disturbing. And I know our National Guard leaders and our U.S. Army Reserve leaders have redoubled their efforts. One of the things we've done at ForceCom to help really sort of re-energize our suicide prevention programs is we've instituted a, now we're doing a monthly review at the ForceCom level where I bring together every commander and command sergeant major, so one and two star commands and up. And I have two commands brief two suicides, the details. You know, what did we know? What didn't we know? What could we have done better? What did we learn in the after action review in the 15-6? So we can share best practices and lessons learned to help prevent future suicides. Now, the other thing I've added is we've added in, I also have two units brief saves, if you will, where our programs have directly contributed to either giving skills, knowledge, and attributes to soldiers and leaders to help intervene to prevent a suicide. And that's really powerful, too, because typically we just focus on what did we miss. And we have saves every day. We never talk about them.
Brilliant.
Our prevention programs are actually preventing suicides. I got to share one with you because it just makes you feel good. There was a young first cavalry trooper driving home late, got off work late, a medic, and he's driving home down 190, and he sees a car stopped on the overpass, and he sees a guy standing on the overpass. So he circles back around the next exit, comes back, and he sees this guy now climbing over the overpass as if he's getting ready to jump. So the kid stops his car and says, "Hey, what are you doing to this other soldier?" And the guy says, "Hey, leave me alone. Just I don't need anything." He doesn't know, the soldier that stopped has no idea who this is. And he says, "No, I'm going to stay right here. I want to talk to you." And he literally talks this guy off the ledge. Then puts him in his car, takes him to McDonald's that's nearby, buys him a cup of coffee, and they're sitting there chit-chatting. And then he says, "Hey, let's call your squad leader." So about an hour into this, the squad leader shows up. And this young specialist, this was specialist, E4, basically hands off this young soldier who was married, had a child, had a lot of stressors in his life. And at that moment, on that night, it was too much for him to handle. And the specialist took it upon himself to just stop. So we asked him, "Hey, specialist," because he was a guest speaker at one of our VTC, this last suicide prevention VTC. So I got him talking the whole force cab leadership. I said, "Hey, why'd you stop?" He said, "Sir, to be honest with you, we all have challenges in our lives. And I hope that if I ever get to that point, and I start to think like this, that somebody would stop for me." And the skills he used to talk that kid off the ledge, he learned at assist training run by our ACS. Now, we don't talk about those success stories, but we ought to. I'm on a path right now to make sure that not only do we talk about those that are, suicides that happen, but those that we prevent. Because there are a lot of stories, just like the one I just described, that are going on. So our prevention is actually working. But one is too many. And so we got to continue to crank up our efforts. that's why this whole thing with our veterans was really bothersome, because, you know, that they don't have that support network like our active duty guys do in uniform. So, but yeah. Thanks for asking.
Well, sir, I really appreciate you taking the time to celebrate that victory, and that's what it is. It's a victory, and, you know, Troy and I are both, you know, with our nonprofit work and other stuff, are deeply entrenched in the veteran suicide situation, but it is so nice to hear and celebrate, like, those victories, because, you know, the statistics are staggering, and I know active duty, I think, you know, two years ago numbers were waiting on 15 numbers, you know, one a day. That's just way too many. But, you know, in addition to that, one of the things I want to share with you quickly, personally, and this is my last thing because I know you're a busy man, is that your texting while driving made a personal impact on me. You were on the show a couple of years ago, and, you know, you spoke about, you know, how much that bothered you and, you know, your efforts as a leader to change that. And, one, I want to tell you, like, thank you, because it made me really take a look at myself. I felt very convicted by that, and I changed, actually, even the vehicle that I have as a result of that. Are you still really promoting that within the forces? And, like, is there anything you want to talk about with that?
You know, when I left 3IP and I went to work for the secretary, I sort of went silent in the Twitter sphere, and although it's terribly rampant in the D.C. area, it's terrible. So I haven't recranked that back up, but I need to. It's a great point. You know, a lot of states now have adopted laws that, you know, make it illegal to do it, which is really great. And I do need to you know, take it on and shine a light back on it. Now, I'll be honest with you, we got a lot of, you know, we have fatalities frequently. I wouldn't say every day, but, you know, one a week inside Forces Command. I can tell you that none of them are directly attributed to this. We got soldiers dying from other things, but not from this yet. But that doesn't mean it's not going on. So, no, my current position, I haven't. But I'm glad to hear that I had an effect. I know I had a effect when I was in 3ID, and I'm glad I had an effect on you, because it really is. It's incredibly dangerous, and we are killing people across the United States.
Yeah. Hey, sir, again, we really appreciate you coming on. Is there any topics that you've covered a lot? Anything you want to tell our listeners about, anything that's near dear to your heart, you want to make sure you get a nugget or ear that we didn't cover before we let you go?
Yep, two things. One is, you know, everybody who's listening, this is what I tell, you know, people from outside the service who often wonder, you know, we spend an awful lot of money on a defense budget and so forth. And, you know, there's a lot of debate about the size of the Army and the size of the armed forces and what they should or should not be doing. And here's what I tell people. If you ever think we're going to need an Army to defend our country, if you ever think we're going to need one, you better have a good one. The only thing that's worse than, you know, being in a war is losing a war. And I don't see that on the horizon right now, but on, you know, the reality is in our force and our Army is, you know, it's expensive. So, we've got to continue to make that investment. Because if we don't, you know, we shrink it too small or we decide to not resource it properly, we'll have a hollow Army. And that, we've got plenty of historical examples of what happens when you do that. We pay the price in the blood and treasure of those who are serving in uniform. And, you know, for our generation, this generation today, who've been, especially in the last 15 years, we've all been to too many memorial ceremonies. We've pinned on too many Purple Hearts. We've seen the horrors of war, and this was a ready Army, and we know how it can be a lot worse if we weren't ready. So if you ever think you're going to need an Army, you better have a good one. So that's one. Second one is there's a misbelief that somehow because our numbers in Iraq and Afghanistan, that the amount of deployments and the tempo of our army is down from what it was at the height of the surge. And the exact opposite is true. Our pace today, as we reduce the overall size of the force, so that, you know, the army's going to 980,000 total, 450 active, 335 guard, 195 in the reserve. The pace of and the tempo inside units, it's as high as it was in 2007, 2008, just doing different things. Training, a lot of rotational missions that we're having to do now as we've reduced overseas footprint. And so my second message is the sacrifice by our soldiers and families is as high as it ever was in terms of separation, deployments, time away from family, and working hard. And so my second message is that, you know, I hope that everybody in America understands that. I certainly do. So do the Army senior leaders. And we are grateful for the sacrifices of our soldiers and families. It doesn't get a lot of fanfare right now, but it is real. And we live in reality. And I couldn't be prouder of them, but very, very grateful for the sacrifice of our soldiers and families today because the tempo has not slowed down one bit for them. Appreciate the opportunity to come on your show tonight, fellas.
Hey, sir, thank you from me, Toby, all of our listeners. They're all typing in and telling us, thank you so much for giving us all the time, pretty much an hour. We know you're a busy guy. Keep going out there and kicking butt, and we'll keep seeing you on Twitter. And everyone knows they can follow you on Twitter at DogPaySoldier, right?
You got it. Thanks.
There we go. All right. Hey, thank you, sir. Everyone, General Abrams, Forces Command Commander, you have a great night, sir.
Thanks.
Good night. All right, here we go. Toby, look at that.
Wow!
What do you think?
Oh, man, like that's, I mean, we hoped for 30 minutes, and we got 58 on air and solid 61 off. No, like, that's amazing. I'm mind blown right now. It's so refreshing to hear, you know, a true state of the forces. You listen to these political speeches, the State of the Union and such, and you get rhetoric. What we just got was from the horse's mouth, the down and dirty, the guys and gals are like, they're in the trenches. They're getting great training. They're meeting the mission task. They're on it. I mean, that is truly phenomenal stuff. And one, I'm super motivated for America right now. Right now, I see eagles flying above me. Everything's great. I'm mind blown.
You know, I've told many people, he is a soldier. And if that last hour didn't just prove it to you, then there's nothing that will. That guy is, from the day I first met him, when he took over command in 1990 of HHC 1-8 cab Mustangs to right now, he's never changed. He has never wavered. And I hope Americans I hope they've heard that themselves.
No, I want to give a quick shout out to like my main man Danimal, Master Sergeant retired Dan Robles from 1-8 Cav, double leg amputee, out there doing great stuff. Served with Abrams, listening in tonight. You know, it's so awesome to see, you know, these guys, you know, follow this leader these years later and throughout his career. You guys I respect, like, he's the real deal. He's a soldier. It's amazing. I'm out.
Yeah. All right. Well, everybody, we appreciate you tuning in tonight. This has been a phenomenal episode. We have been so looking forward to this, and it's not ending tonight. Be sure and join us next week, next Tuesday at 8:00. We are, we've got guests racking and stacking. You know, they may not always be of this caliber, but it's people that have great messages, that have great stories, that are doing great things around the world. So we thank you, if this is your first time listening, for tuning in to Stu and the Nun. Be sure to check us out on stewandthenun.com. Follow us on Facebook at Stu and the Nun or on Twitter at Stu and the Nun. And be sure and follow our guest, Dogface Soldier. There's not too many general officers, especially 4-stars, that are tweeting themselves. They have aides. They have assistants. This guy, he's the real deal. He's doing it himself. He puts up the pictures. He's the one you want to follow. So with all that, I want to wish you a good night.
I'm out. America.
All right. That's right. America. Everybody have a good night. Thank you.